Who's real and who's not today on The World? I'm Marco Werman. Russian internet bots went to work right after the school shooting in Parkland, Florida, putting out divisive messages about gun control, and plenty of people fell for them.
Once real humans start spreading the messages as well, it's extremely hard to tell who's real and who's not.
Also, are the Centers for Disease Control really barred from conducting research on gun violence? This former CDC employee says actually no.
What happened is that there were politicians who were funded by the NRA who passed an amendment that made the CDC feel like they couldn't study guns.
Yep, it's part of what's got those students in Parkland so outraged.
We call BS!
That's all ahead today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thanks for being with us today. Columbine, Virginia Tech, Sandy Hook, and now Parkland, Florida. Sadly, that is an incomplete list of school shootings, but students at the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School are telling lawmakers that it has to stop.
Politicians who sit in their gilded House and Senate seats funded by the NRA telling us nothing could have ever been done to prevent this, we call BS! That tougher gun laws do not decrease gun violence. We call BS! They say a good guy with a gun stops a bad guy with a gun. We call BS!
That's Emma Gonzalez speaking over the weekend in Fort Lauderdale. She attends Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, and she survived last week's mass shooting. Students like her are looking for real change, and at the same time, there's something else that's getting another look: public health research on the causes behind gun violence. It's not really new. In 1996, Congress allocated funds for the Centers for Disease Control to do exactly that. But the bill also included this provision: none of the funds for the CDC may be used to advocate or promote gun control. Catch 22. Seema Yasmin was formerly with the CDC as a disease detective, as well as being an MD. She's also a journalist and a professor. Dr. Yasmin, you say the CDC is not banned from actually studying gun violence, that it's just too scared to do its job?
Absolutely. There isn't really a ban saying that the CDC can't study gun violence. The CDC was studying gun violence from the mid-80s to the mid-90s. But what happened is that there were politicians who were funded by the NRA in the NRA's pockets who passed an amendment that made the CDC feel like they couldn't study guns. Like, if they did, they'd be jeopardizing their own careers and jeopardizing the funding of the entire agency. And when I worked there and I talked to gun researchers there, they said that they just couldn't touch this entire topic of gun violence.
Now, one politician in particular was behind that bill. Hasn't he changed his mind as well?
He has, and that politician is Jay Dickey, who's a lifetime NRA member and a Republican lawmaker from Arkansas. The amendment is named after him. It's the Dickey Amendment. And he has more recently written in the Washington Post that he regrets writing that amendment, and he regrets the impact that it's had. But it's too late, Marco. The damage has been done for the last 25 years, that the United States' premier public health agency hasn't been able to do the kind of research that might stop these mass shootings, these school shootings, and stop gun violence in its tracks.
Why do you think it's too late? I mean, can't that be turned around?
I think it can, but even now, as we're talking, there's still fear in that agency about how to do gun research. In 1996, the CDC was stripped of $2.6 billion, which was then shifted elsewhere, but that was the exact amount of money that the agency had spent the previous year studying gun violence. So these kinds of things send a really clear message about what can and can't be studied.
So let's just pretend that those resources are on track right now. What difference do you think it would make to the whole gun debate if the CDC got more deeply involved in research?
One the CDC does is outbreak response. And the steps that you take to stop an outbreak of measles, funnily enough, are very similar to the steps that you will take to stop an outbreak of gun violence. So if they could really do their job with the freedom they need, we'd understand some of the underlying factors about who gets access to guns, how they do it, what are the triggers, for want of a better word, for these mass shootings in the first place. At the moment, we're just trying to rely on research from other institutions, and we don't really have the data sets and the numbers that we need to understand this problem and how it could be stopped.
Some people would say the United States doesn't have a gun problem because of the Second Amendment and the very way guns are a part of America's social and political fabric. But you're a doctor. Do you think, as an MD, the U.S. has a gun problem?
I do. And I think one of the tricky things is the U.S. has this problem where you're not allowed to talk about guns, especially when I lived and worked in Texas. You start a conversation about guns and it gets everyone's backs up. It's like you have these two sides, one where people love guns and want easy access, and the other side where people hate guns and they want gun control. But that's not really true, because you have people like me, many people like me, who love guns, who enjoy guns recreationally. But we still want better gun control. We still want to live in a world where we don't worry about kids being gunned down inside a school.
Yeah, I think yours is a really important voice on this because, as you say, you appreciate guns. In fact, you once wrote about having a love affair with guns. Can you just tell us about that?
Yeah, I absolutely love guns. I come from a family where people hunted. When I was in medical school in England and my mind would explode because I had to learn so much, I discovered that it wasn't yoga that relaxed me, but it was going to the gun range and shooting with the rifle club. And that was so grounding and focusing. When I moved to the U.S. to work for the CDC, I could go to the gun range and I could shoot handguns, and it's fun. It's a great sport. I enjoy guns. I just don't want people to have access to assault weapons and to magazines that can shoot more than 10 rounds. There's no need for that, but there is a need for a conversation with voices like mine where people enjoy guns, enjoy them recreationally, but are demanding better gun control.
Dr. Yasmin, do you still shoot?
I haven't for a while. I'm in California now, and actually I'm looking for a gun range, but I haven't prioritized that, as you can imagine. I was about to buy a Pearl Handle 22 a couple years back, and then Sandy Hook happened, and I thought, you know what? I don't want to own a gun. I will go to a range, and I will shoot, and I'll do target practice, but right now I don't own, and I haven't been shooting in a while.
I mean, you've got an interesting nuanced view, some would say. Is this whole debate difficult for you?
It is, because the nuance is hard to come through because of these two strong sides that feel that there is only opposition, that there is only this one side that wants no one to have guns and this one side that believes every American should have guns. And we're missing the finer details. I was a professor at the University of Texas at Dallas at the time when the Texas Governor Greg Abbott signed a bill saying that we could have campus carry. I didn't want that. My students were so anxious and so worried about guns being on the campus. So I can enjoy guns, and my students might have enjoyed guns too, but they didn't want them everywhere, and they didn't want everyone having access to them. And right now we don't have that peace of mind because we know the background check system is flawed, and we know that so many policymakers are in the pockets of the NRA.
Dr. Seema Yasmin, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
After the mass shooting in Florida last week, the hashtag gun control now started trending. Sounds reasonable, right? Well, the story of how that hashtag emerged is actually somewhat disturbing. It was used as bait by Russian internet bots and trolls. The goal? To divide Americans even further over guns. Erin Griffith is a senior writer at Wired, and her article, Pro-Gun Russian Bots Flood Twitter After Parkland Shooting, intrigued us. Erin, what is a Russian bot and how does it tweet?
Right. So, yeah, it's important to distinguish a little bit between a troll account that may or may not be associated with a Russian influence campaign and a bot, which is an automated Twitter account that can just, you know, proliferate a message very quickly without a lot of human interaction. So what we saw after the Parkland shooting was a spike on some of the sites that track this kind of activity in the use of the gun control and gun control now hashtags by some of these bots and troll accounts that are associated with Russian influence campaigns.
How hard is it to tell the difference between a troll and a bot if you're just a casual Twitter user?
Well, it's pretty hard to tell who's real and who's not on Twitter. I mean, they don't require real names. Anyone can create an account if it gets kicked off for harassment, which Twitter is clamping down a little bit on certain forms of harassment on the site. But if they get kicked off, they can just start up another one pretty easily. And what we've seen is some of these accounts can kind of be automated and spread messages very, very quickly. And often what happens is these messages can be picked up then by real people who may or may not know that they're interacting with a troll or a bot or a piece of political propaganda campaign. And once real humans start spreading the messages as well, it's extremely hard to tell who's real and who's not.
Yeah, I got to say, I found that one of the scarier parts of your article, where, you know, it's basically human trolls are seeding ideas with bots and then letting them spread until actually there's one that a human really likes and picks up the baton, and then it's viral.
It creates a feedback loop that is very scary. And there are plenty of pro-gun advocates out there that are tweeting about this as well. But the problem is that the Russian influence campaigns are trying to get people's attention to then slip in messages that are more directly related to the Kremlin's agenda, and in hopes that real people will start to spread them. And that is very scary.
I mean, the bots don't have political allegiances, but do the trolls who are kind of like seeding the bots with ideas, do they have political allegiances? I mean, when we're talking Russians.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting, we've seen that they have in the past shared content that is meant to sort of sow discord and rile up people on both sides of a debate. You know, we recently saw with the indictments that Russian influence campaigns are using Facebook to, you know, organize rallies that are on opposing viewpoints in the same place in the same day. And on Twitter, we've seen some similar things around the NFL debates we saw, and around Al Franken's sexual misconduct allegations. We saw them sort of trying to stir up people on both sides. In this case, it looks like they have latched onto the gun control hashtags and actually use it to spread messages that will appeal mostly to right-wing followers for whatever reason. The idea is that it's an emotional, politically charged news event that has a lot of attention and eyeballs. And so if they can, you know, latch onto that and gain an audience out of it, then they can eventually use that as bait to sort of slip in more ideas that are more directly related to their goals.
Aaron, are these operations backed by the Kremlin, and how do we know?
Well, the bots that are tracked by Hamilton 68, they do believe that they have identified groups that are spreading the Kremlin's message. Some of them are directly affiliated, including the official Russian government accounts and some of their media organizations. And some of them are accounts that they have identified as spreading the same messages that may or may not even know that they are doing so.
The gun debate, Aaron, is so divisive and just gets more so. Without these Russian bots and their tweets, do you really believe the U.S. would have a better sense of how to deal with the gun debate?
You know, I do think that this is a small but vocal part of the debate that's raging online. And I think that it adds an element of anger and confusion that might not have been there. I mean, the reason I even started looking into this was because the morning after the shooting, we saw these tweets surfacing of students who were basically sharing their experience of the shooting in real time. And underneath, you see this just rage from people responding to these teenagers who are in the middle of distress right now, calling them fake, not believing them, calling them attention mongers who are out for a book deal or something like that. And I just couldn't understand where this hatred was coming from. And so I do think that these campaigns have been successful in stoking anger and divisiveness, and also just confusion, because there's so much fake information out there. And journalists now have to work almost two jobs, where one, we have to, in a situation like a shooting where stuff is unfolding in real time, figure out what's real and what the truth is, but then also be constantly debunking all of the fake and misinformation that's coming out there, which is its own job almost.
Aaron Griffith with Wired Magazine, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Just ahead on the show, Iran and Saudi Arabia, bitter rivals, but where did the bitterness all begin? You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Syria, Iraq, Yemen, three of the world's bloodiest wars in the last 15 years. They all had unique beginnings, but they have one thing in common. They have, to a large extent, been shaped by the rivalry between two nations, the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. That conflict is the subject of a new series on PBS Frontline starting tonight, titled Bitter Rivals. It was written and produced by Martin Smith, who joins us now. Hey, Martin, good to have you with us again.
Good to be back, Marco.
So before we actually begin chatting, let's just listen to one moment in your documentary. It's from a conversation you had with the Saudi foreign minister, Adel Al-Jubeir, where you are talking about the war in Yemen.
We're not competing with Iran. We don't want to compete with Iran.
You're fighting a war against them in Yemen.
We're not fighting war against them in Yemen. We want them to get off our case. That's what we want.
All right. He's not fighting a war in Yemen. They're not fighting a war in Yemen. He seems kind of to be in denial. So my first question is simply, how real is this rivalry between Iran and Saudi Arabia? As in, how do these two countries actually see it?
It's very real. And, you know, he's dancing around it a little bit there. But he knows, everybody knows, that they've been engaged in a deep rivalry, a bitter rivalry since 1979, really, when Ayatollah Khomeini returned from exile. The Western-backed Shah left the country. The U.S.-backed Shah left. And Khomeini took power and declared that all the monarchies of the Gulf, most notably Saudi Arabia, needed to be toppled. And since then, they've had a very deep enmity between them.
So that brings us to another moment in your documentary. The Iranian talk about exporting their revolution in 1979 understandably unsettled Saudi Arabia with its own Shia minority and its eastern provinces. So you confronted the current Iranian foreign minister, Javad Zarif, about their alleged interference in that region. Let's listen to that.
We made our views clear about the nature of governments that were submissive to the United States, governments that were presenting a message of hatred.
But back in 1979, there were radio reports coming out of Iran calling for Shia in the eastern province of Saudi Arabia to rise up against the monarchy.
Well,
that sounds like interference to me.
We always rejected the use of force against governments. We may have encouraged people to ask for their rights.
So, Martin Smith, you really think that exporting the Islamic Revolution is still on the agenda of the Iranians? Like, what is their end game right now?
It's a revolutionary state. Let me just interject that what you can't see on the radio is the smirk that comes across his face as he says that they may have encouraged some kind of uprising.
And what did that smirk tell you?
That smirk told me that he was admitting that, yeah, we were up to some mischief there. We were encouraging the Shia of the eastern province to rise up because we wanted to get under the skin of the Saudi monarchy.
Right. So back to
no
that other
question about it.
Yeah. Is it still the agenda of the Iranians to do that, to export their revolution?
Well, when they have an opportunity, such as in current-day Yemen, they will do so. They've chosen sides in Iraq. They've dominated the politics of Iraq since the U.S. invasion toppled Saddam Hussein. They've dominated Syria in their support for Assad. So yeah, they're up to this. It's part of their raison d'etre to be a revolutionary state.
I mean, there's obviously a contentious history between Saudi Arabia and Iran, but how much of the Sunni-Shia divide is kind of just a construct for enmity? And if it is, who made it so? And why push such a destructive narrative?
Well, you know, in history, it's amazing that two branches of the same religion with the same basic beliefs can be responsible for so much hatred and violence. I mean, we've seen it in Northern Ireland, and we see it across the Middle East. But this power struggle, as you mentioned earlier, is really much more of a modern construct, a much more of a power struggle for control of the Middle East by two protagonists, Iran and Saudi Arabia. I don't think that Sunnis and Shias would be at each other's throats if it wasn't for these power players funding and stirring up hatreds. So I don't think this is fundamentally a sectarian divide. We like in the West to conceive of it as a Bloods versus Crips or Cowboys versus Indians and therefore Sunnis versus Shia. It helps us maybe understand things in simpler terms, but I think it's false. I think that this is essentially a power struggle between two major countries in the Middle East and not so much a sectarian war.
So if we look at this kind of war between Iran and Saudi Arabia, for lack of a better word, who's winning it and where is it going, especially with Trump's open embrace of Saudi Arabia and renewed hostility toward Iran?
Yeah, it's a good question. Well, I think Iran is winning the war. Iran has won in Iraq. It's won in Syria. It certainly, for a long time, since the 80s, had a foothold in Lebanon with Hezbollah. In Yemen, the Houthi rebellion is entrenched in the capital, Sana'a, and gets humanitarian aid, money, and some weapons from the Iranians. And this is driving the crown prince of Saudi Arabia nuts.
What would it take for Saudi Arabia and Iran to maybe not get along, but to get to some point of détente? Is that possible?
Well, I talk to a lot of people that are a lot smarter than I am in this program and have studied this divide for a long time, and all of them, to a person, say that it's going to get worse before it gets better. Talking to the two foreign ministers in the program, they're at each other's throats, and there's a kind of, a kind of a mean girl's script that they carry where they point at each other and blame each other for what's going on. So there's not a great amount of maturity now. There's a lot of raw feelings, and they both have cases to make, but they're not sitting down and they're not talking.
Martin, you've seen the zones of war, Iraq and Syria and Yemen, that have emerged from this Iran-Saudi rivalry. You've seen the cost of this conflict. What kind of impact has all this had on you?
Well, it's very upsetting. It's very upsetting to see the amount of destruction. And sometimes I feel as I go through these landscapes of destroyed towns, cities, it's war pornography, really, to see too much of this stuff. And we always have to decide how much we're going to put out there on the air because it's sensational on the one hand. But it's also just very deeply disturbing to me to see, in Aleppo in northern Syria, I visited a school that was being rebuilt by the Iranians. But the kids in that school, in a classroom I walked into, were 8 years old. They have lived through 6-7 years of war. They have hardly been able to go to school. So there's so many examples like that of the kind of cost of this for the population. And, I met professionals who talk to us in the film in Syria who feel that they can't leave the country. One man, his wife is having a baby, and I said, "Are you really comfortable raising your child here?" He practically broke down in tears, and he says, "It's my destiny. I can't leave."
Martin Smith produced Bitter Rivals, a two-part series about Iran and Saudi Arabia on Frontline, airing tonight and next Tuesday. Martin, thanks so much for your time.
Marco, thank you.
I'm Marco Werman. Britain is in crisis, a chicken crisis. Kentucky Fried Chicken franchises there have run out of their main ingredient.
It's a chicken place, so they should have enough chicken.
Unbelievable, really, that all the chicken, there's farmers, surely there's enough chickens.
Not making it up, I promise. Find out what happened, still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI and WGBH here in Boston. An election focused on the economy and immigration. That must sound familiar. Italians head to the polls on March 4th. The country has been in the middle of Europe's big migrant story since 2015. Now, the number of people trying to cross the Mediterranean into Europe has dropped dramatically. But still, in Italy, the phrase Italians first seems to be popping up more and more ahead of the vote there. Reporter Megan Williams told me why.
What's happened is members of the right-wing coalition, that includes Silvio Berlusconi, the former prime minister, and a couple of other groups that are further to the right, have seized upon a sense of anxiety that Italians have about the future and focusing it on the immigration issue. And Italians feel like they've been abandoned by the rest of Europe.
I know there have been a few instances of violence in Italy recently. A few weeks ago, there was a gunman who targeted African immigrants and shot and wounded about six people. What has that done to change the tone of the election?
That was an act of violence, an act of terror against migrants. Yet the right-wing party, La Lega, which used to be a northern party that was against southern Italians, it's now shifted its ire towards migrants. They somehow seized upon that shooting against migrants and turned it into proof that migrants were a problem for Italy, that Italy is letting in too many people. Now, a week before that shooting, the body of an 18-year-old Italian woman was found in two separate suitcases. She'd been murdered, and the prime suspect in that murder was a Nigerian man. So obviously everybody made the connection between that murder and the shooting of these six Africans who had nothing to do with it. Really anything that happens with immigrants, it seems, in Italy somehow ends up being fodder for this far-right party, La Lega. And they've seen that it's successful, and Berlusconi Berlusconi has too. I mean, he's made promises to expel the 600,000 migrants that have arrived here over the past 4 years, which, you know, just seems very unlikely.
What is the mood in Italy right now, Megan? And if you're one of those immigrants, how are you feeling?
I think what we're seeing is there are a lot of Italians that are immigrants now, and they don't really have a voice. So I think that population in the country feels really beleaguered. And I think it feels like there's a lot of hostility aimed at your group. The problem is the largest opposition to the right-wing group is the center-left. Now, the problem with the center-left is they have splintered. They're fighting amongst themselves, and they're also afraid to bring up the issue because they're seen as somehow linked to this so-called crisis of migrants arriving in Italy, even though, you know, it predated the center-left. It happened when Berlusconi was in power. But they've remained largely silent. So it's allowed the right-wing coalition to take up airspace. There are a few smaller groups. Emma Bonino, who's a pro-European politician, she's been speaking out on behalf of immigrants and migrants. And there's a new little party that's popped up that seems to be attracting voters very quickly called Power to the People. It's with a lot of Italian young people. They're pro-European and pro-migrant. So there's a little bit, but nobody really knows what's going to happen. I mean, the right-wing coalition seems to have more votes than the left-wing coalition. What probably will happen is a really messy, prolonged period after the vote where the poor president of Italy will have to come up with a solution, either a grand coalition or some sort of solution that makes everybody happy, and it'll be a bit of a patchwork situation, which Italy has lived with for a long time.
I reported out of Rome in 95 for a while, and this may sound odd, but compared with Paris, I was struck by how uniformly Italian everything was. It was hard to even find an Asian restaurant. And now it's become a key actor in this overwhelming migrant story since 2014, and Italian faces are diverse today. How comfortable are Italians generally with that change?
Well, that's an interesting observation because Italy is really still a very culturally unified country in a lot of ways. I mean, there's the north-south divide, but certainly there's a strong cultural imprint. And, you know, as you say, in 95, there weren't a lot of immigrants at the time. There are many more. A lot of them are marginalized still. A lot of them, you know, are not integrated yet into Italian society. What I would say about Italy is that on an institutional level, it's a bit of a disaster. It just cannot seem to get its act together with a lot of social programs. But on an individual level, you know, and migrants tell me this all the time, people who have been in Germany and had social support in Germany ended up back in Italy because on an individual human level, they feel seen by Italians. Their humanity seems received, you know. And I think that is the strong point about Italians is that when it comes down to it, it's a country of welcoming people.
That's a fascinating paradox. Reporter Megan Williams in Rome, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco. A pleasure.
Italy is not the only country wrestling with the consequences of migration. We are here in the U.S., obviously. So is Australia. The world's Shirin Jafari has a story of some refugees in legal limbo with the Australian government and a deal that was supposed to help some of them out.
Late last month, Abdul Aziz Adam tweeted this video. It shows a group of young men at an airport, all glued to their cell phones. Safe journey, guys, Abdul Aziz wrote in his caption. I'm sure the American people will give you welcome at the airport. Abdul Aziz is not with them. He's one of about 2,000 refugees the men in the video left behind, thousands stranded in Australia's offshore detention centers in the South Pacific, on Manus Island in Papua New Guinea and in Nauru. Australia says it won't take them. If it does, more will follow. But the U.S., it said it will take some of them.
I've got the Skype window open. Okay. I see you.
In 2016, the Obama administration struck a deal with the Australian government.
That's correct. In fact, I signed the agreement.
That's Anne Richard.
I am the former Assistant Secretary of State for Population, Refugees and Migration.
Richard says Australia has long been criticized for conditions at its offshore camps. She's criticized them herself. And in fact, it was after her criticism that the Australians came forward with a proposal. Could the U.S. resettle some of the refugees stuck on these islands?
We were surprised by it. Their proposal was not something that we had heard about in advance.
But it was good timing.
President Obama wanted us to bring more refugees to the United States. He wanted a significant increase in the number of refugees we were bringing every year. So this also fit into that overall policy.
Remember, this was happening at the time when thousands of refugees were dying on their way to Europe. The time when the body of a Syrian toddler, Alan Kurdi, washed up on the shores of Turkey.
The whole world woke up to the fact that there were massive numbers of people uprooted and on the move.
Within a year, the two countries had a deal.
The deal itself remains classified, so I can't outline for you all of the terms of the deal, but the overall impetus on the part of the U.S. was, we will take these people, we will take large numbers of people from Australia, but they should do a number of things.
One thing Australia had to do in return was to accept refugees from Central America. Why Central America? Because of what's known as the Protection Transfer Agreement. Bear with me here. Before the talks with Australia, there was a spike in gang violence in Central America. People from Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala were desperate to flee. Many were coming to the U.S. To help manage the situation, the International Organization for Migration, United Nations, and the Costa Rican government negotiated an agreement. The PTA.
I thought it was a really interesting idea.
Caitlin Forat teaches at California State University, Long Beach. She was doing research in Costa Rica when the agreement was announced.
So the idea was that the program would very quickly be able to evaluate people who needed to flee and move them to Costa Rica, where they would then undergo the rest of their processing before being resettled in the U.S. or somewhere else.
So when the time came to speak with the Australians, the U.S. said, yes, we'll take about 1,200 refugees from your detention camps if you take the refugees being housed in Costa Rica. Australia said, deal. A spokesperson for the State Department wouldn't say how many Central Americans are going to be resettled in Australia under the deal. According to reports, though, so far 30 people have made it there. But Forat worries about how they're going to adjust to their new home.
Those who, in many cases, were trying to get to the U.S. had family or had contacts in the United States that would have helped them with settlement, with integration, with getting started in the country. And I don't know, you know, being transferred to a country where they have no contacts, no social networks, no personal support networks, I think would be very difficult for them.
Meanwhile, human rights groups say the U.S. deal doesn't solve problems on Manus Island. Last week, the UN said there's a worsening sense of despair among the refugees there.
Hello.
I talked to Behruz Buchani, a Kurdish journalist who's been on Manus Island for 5 years. He told me he knows about the U.S. deal. He knows people who've gone.
Until now, about 80 people left Manus. They are living in America, but we don't know what will happen for others.
It's unlikely that he will be among the people the U.S. agrees to resettle. The majority of the refugees who've been accepted are from Afghanistan and Pakistan. Buchani is from Iran, one of the countries on President Trump's travel ban. I ask him how he feels about that.
What can we do? Nothing. Yeah, just we are waiting.
Trump initially called the U.S.-Australia agreement a dumb deal. He asked the Australian Prime Minister if anyone knew who the refugees are and would they, quote, become the Boston bomber in 5 years. But eventually, he said he would stick with the agreement, though taking in fewer refugees than originally negotiated. It's not what Anne Richard worked for. Still, she says, taking some refugees is better than taking none.
I'm hopeful that once these first few groups have arrived and behave like so many refugees have arriving in the U.S. before, we shall see that they make perfectly fine Americans. The U.S. has had a proud history of being a home for refugees and immigrants. And so if we are not going to continue that, who are we?
For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Next up, we're going to hear from a rapper from the Bay Area in California. Her name is Ruby Ibarra, and she uses hip-hop to talk about life as a first-generation Filipina-American.
It started in the Philippines, Francis M. to kill a beast, till I was 13, spitting soliloquies on Dilla Beats. Silly me for thinking these, television imagery, representing me, but most these people never look like me.
I know for my parents, their number one goal was always and will always be me and my sister, you know, getting an education and living a life more comfortable than they ever did in the Philippines. But I think my parents, and as well as other immigrant families, are never really prepared for the harsh realities that they experience once they come here.
They said, welcome, welcome, welcome. I said, welcome to the Philippines. Mabuhay, where we sleep Americana dreams. A new life behind the politics and smoky screens. The new life to be exploited by regime machines. Till you die. They said, welcome to the USA. And they said, welcome to the USA.
A song like The Other Side, I just wanted to talk about my family's goals and hopes, and I could see that struggle with my parents and them being adult immigrants here and, you know, still having ties to the homeland and feeling like they were outsiders.
Mama, why don't they like me? Comma, they don't look like me. Papa, they ask his ID. Ego, it wants to fight me. Ruby, don't take it lightly. Just focused on plotting nightly.
Colorism is important to me because I just remember hearing it all the time as a kid. You know, I would play outside in the summers and I'd come back in and then my aunties would always be like, "Oh, you look so haggard and you're getting dark." Like I tell my friends, every time I go back home to the Philippines and I see, you know, these aisles and aisles of skin whitening soaps and lotions, and, you know, these are still ads that continue to run in 2018. Why don't we have people that look like my sister? Why don't we have people that look like my mother? So there needs to be more diversity is just what I'm trying to get at with songs like Brownout.
They teach me to erase that brown subconsciously. I lose my crown till I don't even recognize the person that's inside me now. We came from the slums once, now living the humdrum.
I definitely made it a point to include the other dialects like Tagalog and Waray. And from a rapper standpoint, Waray and Tagalog, I feel, are very percussive. I felt like it was perfect for hip-hop. I'm not here to say that my experience, especially in the album, you know, it's like the definitive Filipino-American experience. It's just one lens, one glimpse of the story. And if people want to call this activism, then so be it. At the end of the day, I just want to speak music that's real and that's true.
No need for introduction, you're here when you know why. No dive into an era with the beats to lo-fi. Put my face in the book cause my people are profile. Erase from the books and my people are told lies. Sky's the limit, go fly. Cali green, we go high. I mean back in 05.
We've got video of Ruby Ibarra singing the song. It's called Here. That's over at PRI.org. Our story was produced by Paula Mardo.
Here to give a new America, like Erica Wright. Try to take my title, never want to inherit the rights. Yeah, Doc Robin City's finest. Put me on the five list. Color up the lines, cause I color like your iris. Hunger in my eyes, this is everything that I risk. Kill it with my tongue every time.
By now you know me and some of my habits. One that I don't think I've copped to yet is my love of fried chicken. In a box or a bucket, doesn't matter. In Japanese katsu curry, as Austrian chicken schnitzel, homemade. My good doctor says watch it, and maybe all of the United Kingdom should pay attention to those words of advice, especially now that the entire UK is in the midst of a crisis, a breaded, greasy, deep-fried crisis. Since yesterday, most of the 900 Kentucky Fried Chicken outlets in the UK have been unexpectedly closed. The reason? A sudden shortage of one crucial ingredient in the Colonel's secret recipe, chicken itself. Yeah, KFC without the C. It's hit many Britons hard, as the BBC found out.
My reaction is angry, sad, and disappointed.
It's a chicken place, so they should have enough chicken.
Unbelievable, really, that all the chicken, as farmers, surely there's enough chickens.
Nope, here's the deal. British KFC franchises recently changed the delivery company for their meat, and the new company admits they were unprepared for the demand. KFC says things are slowly returning to normal and restaurants are reopening. But in the meantime, some store managers have found a temporary fix. This viral video appears to show KFC employees taking chickens from their cars in through the back door of a restaurant.
Smuggling chickens!
Residents who were watching were not impressed.
Oh, they're smuggling chickens! He's smuggling chickens in his Volvo! Oh!
For their part, KFC hastily built a website to help chicken-jonesing locals find the few shops still open. But it may be too late for that. Several British members of Parliament have reported angry questions from constituents. And on Twitter, police in one part of London have asked people to actually stop contacting them about such paltry matters. And finally today, the county of Kent in southern England is a pretty peaceful place. Rolling fields, quaint seaside towns. But it wasn't always this way. And now a debate about the area's ancient bloody history has been dividing people again. The World's Leo Hornack went to the villages of Deal and Walmer to find out more.
More than 2,000 years ago, something terrible and violent happened here.
Sorry to disturb you, I'm from BBC. I'm doing a programme about the plaque to Julius Caesar just along there.
Oh, yeah, we see it every day, yeah. Every time we walk past, yeah, it's really nice. Yeah, it's nice to have it.
We're talking about a pretty bloody chapter in Britain's early history.
It's heritage, isn't it, and that sort of thing, you know, that you see things like that. It's because things that people do things like that instead of just forgetting them, do you know what I mean? I think it's a great idea.
In 55 BC, to be exact, Julius Caesar's forces made their first landing here on this beach, determined to push beyond the known world and conquer the mysterious island peoples of this territory.
You got plenty of sunshine, plenty of beach. It's really nice. Yeah, the pubs. Yeah, it's nice.
It is nice. But the villages of Deal and Walmer were on the seafront between them. Are also not the most eventful place now. And that's why, maybe, keeping the memory of Caesar's brutal landing here has been so important to the area. And here, just in front of me, on the beach, they've made this clear with a pretty enormous concrete monument with a picture of Julius Caesar, which says, the first Roman invasion of Britain landed near here, LVBC, which means 55 BC. Caesar made a second landing a year later, this time with even more troops. There's a long-running campaign for a statuary diorama to be built on the beach, a kind of life-size army of statues, of British and Roman warriors locked in mortal combat. So far, funding's been a problem.
It's called in English the Gallic War, or the Bello Gallico. It's by Julius Caesar.
Andrew Fitzpatrick is an archaeologist at the University of Leicester who's been leading a project to research the invasion. And some of the most important clues are in Caesar's own first-hand description of the battle, which still survives.
He himself reached Britain about the fourth hour of the day, and there beheld the armed forces of the enemy displayed on all the cliffs. Such was the nature of the ground.
We're standing on the spot itself, the very beach where our country's recorded history begins, and where, just offshore, Caesar's legionaries hesitate for a few moments in their warships. And then the eagle-bearer of the 10th Roman Legion begins the attack.
He cast himself forth from the ship and began to bear the eagle against the enemy. Then our troops exhorted one another and leapt down from the ship with one accord. The fighting was fierce on both sides.
There's only one problem. Fitzpatrick's research has revealed something worrying. It didn't happen here. None of it. We've got the wrong beach.
Well, I don't see how the shingle shore at Walmer can be described as even. It is steeply banking, it's shelved, there's a strong undertow, we can hear the stones being pulled underneath now, and the sea's very calm. And to land a fleet of almost 100 ships and keep them at anchor here for a month, I think isn't practical.
And there are other things that don't make sense.
Caesar describes the Britons can rush into the sea and fight against them. And you can't rush into a steeply shelving shingle beach and fight. You would fall. So I think Caesar has to be describing somewhere else.
A few miles inland, Fitzpatrick's team have also uncovered more evidence. The remains of Caesar's actual fort, built when his forces returned a year later. And that's also full of clues that indicate an invasion point a few miles north, at a completely different place. A different, sleepy, picturesque holiday beach called Pegwell Bay.
I cannot agree.
Peter Jull is a local councillor. He's the guy who's campaigned for years for the diorama to be built on the original beach.
We're looking for some bronze statues of the Romans on the beach side of the promenade and some statues of the Britons on the grass side of the promenade. So as people walk along the promenade, they walk through the middle.
But he's not surrendering. He just needs the funding.
I'm a fan of history, and it is Deal's claim to fame. I'm Deal born and bred.
And on the front line, on the beach, the defending British are still defiant.
It's still not been finally proved. So, as Deal loyalists, we still believe that he landed here.
A bit disappointing?
Yeah, really disappointing. I had visions of the Romans clambering up on the beach and just making camp here, but it wasn't at all. I've been deluded all these years.
He probably took one look at the locals and thought he'd go up to Pegwell Bay.
For the World, Leo Hornack, Kent, England.
And we leave you today along the tranquil Kent seashore. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.